refused to concede defeat. He said in recent remarks that time will tell which administration will take office in the White House in January.
Whatever happens in the future, who knows which administration it will be? I guess time will tell.
The remarks are the first indication that Trump could concede defeat in the disputed November 3rd presidential election. Still, some of Trump's supporters, as well as his fellow Republicans, are refusing to budge and remain hopeful that their candidate still has the chance to become the next president. The controversy over the election results comes against the backdrop of pro- and anti-Trump demonstrations. Trump supporters back his vote-rigging claims, while his opponents are happy with the projected victory of Joe Biden. Nevertheless, experts believe the nature of the U.S. regime will not change no matter who takes the reign at the White House.
What we're seeing is that the people who control both parties, the Democrats and Republicans, they want Trump out. You know, Trump is not perfect by any means. He's actually really bad for the American people. But the one thing that we can all give him credit is that he exposed the reality of the U.S. empire. He showed just how brutal it is. And I think for a lot of people on Wall Street and Washington who want to rebrand U.S. empire, Trump is too dangerous. And it's looking every day like Trump may be forced to concede.
Now, it remains to be seen who will be confirmed in office as the next U.S. president and whether or not there will be any major policy changes in the new administration.
On September 17, a resolution issued by the European Parliament urged EU member states to impose an arms embargo on Saudi Arabia over the killing of journalist Jamal Khashoggi and the Yemen war. The resolution also contained an arms embargo on Cairo and Ankara, motivated by concerns Europeans' arms and military equipment might be used for internal repression in Egypt, and that Turkey's conduct in the Eastern Mediterranean Sea would run counter to the sovereignty of any EU member state. While some EU countries such as Germany, Finland and Denmark have adopted restrictions on the arms exports to Riyadh, Italy and other EU nations have ignored the resolution in full so far.
It's unacceptable that Egypt, a country known for human rights abuses, is the top importer of Italian weapons across the world. Saudi Arabia follows. We can't accept that countries involved in wars continue to receive our military equipment. Unfortunately, Italy hasn't done much since the EU Parliament adopted the resolution.
An Italian government report has found that the Unit for the Authorizations of Armament Materials greenlighted 57 times last year the supply of military systems, including bombs, torpedoes, rocket launchers and missiles, worth about 200 million euros to Saudi Arabia and UAE.
One in four arms sold worldwide in 2019 were produced in Europe, according to a report by CIPRI, the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute. France and Germany topped the list of European countries that trade in arms, while Italy came third.
We often look at the US as the main arms supplier worldwide. However, we forget that Europe also plays a major role. If the European Parliament only issues resolutions and not directives, all those countries not observing arms embargo cannot be sanctioned. Furthermore, there is a lack of political will among EU countries for change. European companies even compete with one another to sell more arms in conflicting countries.
Consecutive Italian governments have also ignored a domestic law passed in 1990 which bans the exports of weapons in countries in a state of war. Italy's arms exports stood at over 5 billion euros in 2019. Max Civili, Rome.
The United States presidential election continues to be unfinished and disputed. Democrat Joe Biden holds a slim lead, but President Donald Trump has significant public support from Republicans at the grassroots and elite levels to not concede. The election was preceded by months of controversy regarding the unprecedented use of mail-in ballots, which appeared to swing the election in the slight favor of Joe Biden at the last minute. A recent poll showed that a whopping 70% of Republicans do not believe the election was free and fair. Polls held just prior to the vote showed just half the number of Republican skeptics. Democrats say vote fraud has not yet been proven and that Trump must concede to prevent increasing distrust towards the nation's electoral process. But this is the third disputed election in the last six tries. Many are insisting that this election must be judicially vetted in order to prevent even more alienation, apathy, abstention, and anger. Others say the economic, social, and health disaster caused by the coronavirus makes this not the year to insist on transparency.
Six elections, that's my entire lifetime. So one in two of elections in my lifetime, and only I've been able to only vote in the last, I think, three of them. Or four of them. That says a lot about people's uncertainty of these elections, and that's just only going to grow if the system remains how it is.
The repeated electoral chaos is likely to undermine perpetual U.S. claims that their model of democracy is not only the best, but should be emulated around the world. Harvard ranked U.S. election integrity just 57th in the world. And that was last year.
This is not a model of a political system that would want to be mimicked. And it would only be mimicked if it's being used by the powerful. It would only be mimicked by them because they want something that undermines a majority view. And you should reject that entirely. If you really are for the small d democracy, if you're really for that, you would reject the American model of electing presidents.
The corporate-dominated U.S. mainstream media appears to have a united front that Biden won the election and that any legal challenges are frivolous. A significant percentage of over 70 million Trump voters don't appear to agree. Weeks of chaos and tensions appear certain as the Electoral College, the vote which actually decides the U.S. president, doesn't meet until December 14th. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Insulting the Prophet is a manifestation of the dark, savage civilization of the West, November 11th, 2020.
The incidents related to insulting the Holy Quran and the Holy Prophet have frequently occurred in Western countries, in both the U.S. and European countries. But such incidents cannot damage the honor, magnificence, and greatness of the Holy Prophet of Islam in the slightest manner. It is completely clear that the enlightened personality of the Messenger of Mercy cannot be damaged with these actions. By Allah's favor, this sun shines more brightly on a daily basis. Just as the thugs in Mecca and Taif could not erase the name of the Holy Prophet of Islam, despite all the efforts that they made, these excellencies will not be able to damage the Holy Prophet either. These courses of action show the dark nature of the Western civilization. It indicates that that civilization and culture and that modern jahiliya, ignorance, is really dark and wild in its nature and in its reality.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want or need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor. taught me faith to be stronger.
Of course, they're hiding this savagery. That is because they are equipped with science and technology. They cover their savagery up with science and technology, and they hide it this way. They appear in public by uttering civilized words with a humanistic appearance and by wearing ties and perfume, thus covering up their inner savagery. So Islam and the Holy Prophet are not harmed this way, but this is a means so that you and I can gain a deeper understanding of that civilization. That civilization is really a wild civilization. It has also created a disastrous situation for its nations. In the present time, even after the passage of several centuries from the beginning of that civilization during the Renaissance, you can witness inequality, poverty, injustice, and moral decadence in European countries, in the US, and in those countries which follow them. This is the nature of that civilization and culture.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
Hi, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning.
Morning, sir.
Half a kilo of halim, please.
Hi, Kitty. Good morning.
Number one, hands up. Number two, hands on the waist.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Get ready for jogging to warm up.
Hello, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
One loaf of well-baked bread, please.
application on Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with Thee. So recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday five things, which none embraces but Thy generosity, and none supports but Thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey Thee. Worship by which I may deserve Thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that Thou makest me secure in the places of fear through Thy security. And placest me in Thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household. And make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profit on the day of resurrection. Surely, Thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
The debate.
Hello and a warm welcome to the debate. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. There are many who may consider Canada to be a safe haven for immigrants wishing to start a new life there. Yet horrible things happening to the black community, the people of First Nation and non-white immigrants indicate a fact that although people can live there freely, they can never be equal to white Canadians. International rights organizations have reported an array of violations in Canada, including rights of Indigenous people, violence against Indigenous women and girls, children in immigration detention, mining industry abuses, and sexual orientation, as well as gender identity. Now stay with us for a debate on that issue.
Canada has always been considered a safe haven for immigrants who come from across the world to start a new life in the Northern American country. But many believe that the terrible things that happen to the black community of Canada, the people of First Nation and non-white immigrants, suggest that although they can live freely in Canada, they can never be equal to white Canadians.
There's no systemic discrimination. There's no system in Quebec.
Thank God that we're different than the United States.
But experts believe that Canada has been actually founded on systemic discrimination, and the authorities' denial is part of the systemic racism. They say Canada's society has been made based on white supremacy. Systemic racism means normalizing racism. Non-white Canadians say they face systemic racism on an almost daily basis.
This country was founded on systemic discrimination.
The Canadian government says that Canada is radically different from the US when it comes to racism. But the truth is, both countries have been founded on stolen and colonized lands. Both countries have attempted genocide on Indigenous people. And both countries have a dark history in slavery. And now, decades later, non-white and Indigenous communities of Canada are still struggling with police brutality. This attitude has also resulted in an increase in the number of hate crimes against non-white population of Canada. Joyce Achakuan heard racist and degrading comments from healthcare workers at a hospital in Montreal only moments before her death in September. She was one of the thousands of women who faced maltreatment because of her ethnicity. Canada has been coming to terms with racial injustice suffered by its Indigenous people in recent years. In 2019, a government inquiry found that Canada was complicit in, quote, race-based genocide against Indigenous women. The report said Indigenous women were 12 times more likely to be killed or disappear than other women in Canada. The inquiry said the cause was the deep-rooted colonialism and state inaction. It also found that persistent and deliberate human and Indigenous rights violations and abuses are the root cause behind Canada's staggering rates of violence. The Canadian government has repeatedly pledged to address these issues. But to this day, the number of racially motivated abuses still continues to rise.
Well, we got a couple of guests from Canada to discuss this. Joining me will be Chair of the Community Coalition Against the Racism in Hamilton, Ken Stone, who's joining us out of Hamilton, Ontario. We also have author and columnist Robert Fantina out of Kitchener, Ontario. Good to have both of you, gentlemen, on the show. Let's go to Ken. Major human rights organizations report serious rights violations in Canada. They include wide-ranging abuses against Indigenous people, the continued confinement of immigration detainees in jails, a prison law that does not rule out prolonged solitary confinement, the overseas operations of Canadian extractive companies, and on top of all of these, a growing number of Indigenous women and girls either going missing or being murdered. Can you educate us in more details about the human rights situation in Canada?
The Canadian government and the colonial empires that ran Canada before Confederation were based on a racist and capitalist colonization of North America, in which Native people were considered as subhuman, and they were, from the very first contacts, killed on the spot. They were ethnically cleansed. Sometimes they were captured and made as household slaves. Later they were marginalized. Sometimes they were pressed into becoming the foot soldiers of one empire, the French or the British, against the other. They were used as workers in the colonial fur trade empires. They were finally marginalized onto reservations with their lands taken away from them, their cultures destroyed. And what you see today is the result of 500 years of exploitation. It's not just Native people. As you correctly pointed out in the intro to this program, immigrants from all parts of the world have suffered racism in Canada. The Japanese were interned in World War II. The Chinese were subject to a head tax. The Sikhs were not prohibited to immigrate. The Jews were not given the safe passage or allowed to come into the country to free Nazi Germany. Mm-hmm. The Orange Order was founded. It was continued here to keep the Irish down. It goes on and on. Racism has played a large role in Canada because the powers that be use it to exploit various groups at the lowest wages they can, and to turn groups against each other. And that's why we say that people who have suffered from racism need to unite with other people who have suffered from racism and discrimination and change this society fundamentally, right down to the roots of who holds power and why.
All right. Let me ask Robert this question. Robert, Indigenous women are 12 times more likely to be killed or disappeared than other women in Canada. And this is based on government inquiry last year that found Canada complicit in race-based genocide against Indigenous women. Where does this emanate from?
I think there are a couple of sources. One is that, as Mr. Stone said, Canada is a colonial nation. It's occupying Indigenous people's lands and continues to and has for, of course, centuries. And that's this marginalization of the Indigenous women and men and children too is all part of that. Now, we have what's been referred to as missing white women syndrome. If a white woman goes missing, it's major news. Her picture is on all the news outlets. Tearful requests for her return are presented on the news programs. However, if a non-white woman is missing, it's not the case, because society has said they aren't as important, that women of color are simply not equal to women to white women. And this is a long-standing tradition, that may not be the right word, but it's built into the fabric of the country, because the country was founded on the genocide of the people who lived here for centuries. And they've been pushed onto reservations, they've been marginalized, they live in terrible conditions. And this continues because it serves the needs of the white power structure. And until that changes, nothing else is going to change for the people who are suffering.
Right. Now, Robert says that Canada was founded on the genocide. There are also some experts arguing that Canada was also founded on a systemic discrimination and white superiority. What's your opinion?
Absolutely. The people who founded what is now Canada, that is to say, the people who took over and colonized what is now Canada, the British and the French mainly, had the view, the British had the view that they had a white man's burden to lift up the native people and bring them up to the standard, their standards. Of course, they never did that. The French had the mission of civilization, the mission civilatrice, where they would bring the poor heathens into the Roman Catholic religion and teach them the right way. These were just the cover stories for their systemic racism. They had no intention of ever bringing these people into full participation in society. And in fact, in some cases, such as in Newfoundland, the British colonial government there participated in the extermination of the Beothuks, which is a shameful chapter in Canadian history. Canadian society, right until this day, it's a class society, and the people who are at the top of the class are mainly white, Anglo-Saxon, Protestant males, and they seek to maintain their domination through a system of policing, laws, jails, denial of opportunities for education, medical care, housing, and every other aspect of society you can think of to the people at the bottom, and who are largely native. But there's also people who are at the bottom who are of color, people who are black, new immigrants. They are all put through the mill. And it's a self-perpetuating system whereby the people at the top use the racism to turn white people against people of color and people of other ethnic origins and native people. And for centuries, this has gone on. But there has been a growing anti-racist movement and a growing movement of solidarity with Native people that is pulling together people from all these groups and demanding equality and justice and restorative justice for the Native people, especially, who have lost their lands, their culture, their health, their dignity, who had their children taken away from them in the residential school system. A lot of their Canada, as you said, has made strides in the last number of years in trying to restore, have some kind of accounting and change. And we have to applaud the people who have done that, and the certain changes in government where they've paid out land claims, they've paid compensation for the residential schools, they've made apologies, they've had royal commissions without an end. Unfortunately, you could paper your house with all the recommendations from those piles and piles of royal commission reports that have never been implemented. Nonetheless, the struggle continues, and it's the duty of all Canadians, whatever color, to help to support the Native people in their struggles, such as the one that's taking place just a few miles from where I'm sitting, where the 1492 Land Back Group is taking back a piece of land on which a developer wished to make a new subdivision. I had the pleasure of joining with a trade union delegation of Solidarity that went to see them and bring them supplies the other day. That's the kind of thing that Canadians have to do.
Right. Now, Robert, the Ottawa government is saying that Canada is radically different from the United States when it comes to racism. Do you agree? Could you kind of draw a comparison between the two?
Canada seems to paper it over a little bit more more carefully, but the racism is still there. This is seen in some of the statistics that you mentioned earlier regarding the disappearances and deaths of Indigenous women. Also, the United Nations Proclamation on the Rights of Indigenous People was passed, and earlier this year, a bill was introduced into the Canadian Parliament to bring standards up to that, and it did not pass. So this is, again, where an attempt was made to try to bring things more equal, try to end the racism, and it failed, which is something that one would expect in the United States. But Canada has this image of not being racist. But we look at the same kinds of situations. We look at the number of non-whites who are in solitary confinement. We look at the number of immigrants who are caged. In the U.S., for a time, that was there was outrage against that, but that passed. It's old news, but it's still happening. But it continues to happen. It happens also, perhaps to a lesser degree, but also in Canada. There's other systemic racism. It is part and parcel of the establishment of the nation of Canada, the same way it was part of the establishment of the nation of the United States. It's endemic in its society and in its makeup, and changing it is not going to be easy, but it must be done.
Right. Canada government, as you know, has repeatedly promised to deal with such issues that we're talking about. It's also pledged a long-awaited national inquiry on missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls, but it has failed to do so. Why is that the case?
It's not a priority for the government. Mr. Fantino said in previous comment, the Canadian government doesn't live up to its international obligations concerning Indigenous peoples, and it doesn't live up to even its own promises of what it will do to help Native people in Canada. And one of those is the missing and murdered Indigenous women. The commission has gone on for years. I don't see any radical changes about to take place, and I'm afraid probably that any recommendations will probably end up on the shelf gathering dust along with the other royal commissions that have taken place over the last 40 or 50 years. So I think that it's up to ordinary Canadians to take a stand here, to become active in their communities, and to take a positive role in fighting racism. I think that, in fact, that's the only way that things change in Canada is when there's a grassroots pressure on the government to do something. For example, in this particular, in the case of pipelines, when the government wanted to put a pipeline through the Wet'suwet'en lands, and people took to the streets, and people blocked roads, people blocked highways and railway tracks.
Right.
That forces the government to come to terms. And even now in Caledonia, just a few miles from here, where the 1492 Land Act has been holding out for a couple of months now, despite arrests, being shot at with rubber bullets, being beaten by police, they're holding out. And now there's talk that the federal and provincial governments may sit down to negotiate something, which is something they should have done at the very beginning.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, they never even bothered to consult the traditional leadership of the Haudenosaunee people, that is to say, the leadership, the traditional chiefs of the Six Nations,
right,
who have been sitting on the, you know, brought into Canada and settled here as a result of the American Revolutionary War around 1784. So they've been here over 200 years on that land, and that land has been taken away from them progressively, year chunk by chunk, year by year. Now they want some of it back, and they're going to get it.
Mm-hmm. Now, Robert, Canada is also continuously exporting military equipment and weapons to countries with a record of human rights violations. Can you tell us something about this?
Yes, this is another violation of human rights that's a stain on Canada's record. Canada does export weapons, does sell weapons to anyone who wants to buy them. And this is in the U.S. model, certainly. It's certainly lucrative for the government, and it brings in quite a bit of revenue, but it is still in violation of international law. These other countries should not be receiving weapons unless and until they can bring their human rights practices up to at least a minimum standard, which they don't do. The Canadian government must immediately stop these sales. It's a violation of human rights within Canada because it violates Canadian law, but also it fosters the violation of human rights by these other countries. They continue to oppress their people, to kill their people and other people. So it's as if Canada is pulling the trigger and dropping the bombs themselves by providing this weaponry. So this is another thing that needs to stop, and that is the Canadian government seems to hide sometimes. It's not clearly recognized how much weaponry that Canada does sell to other countries and who it sells it to. But if this were known, Canada would lose its undeserved reputation as a peacemaker and as a country that fosters diplomacy and justice. These are myths, unfortunately, that the government has fostered, but the reality is simply not the case.
Okay, that note, we come to the end of this debate. Let me thank our guests. We had Chair of the Community Coalition Against Racism in Hamilton, Ken Stone, who joined us from Hamilton, Ontario, and author and journalist Robert Fantina out of Kitchener, Ontario. I've been your host, Behrouz Najah.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Limelight. Crawling for prey at more than 1,000 feet under the surface, the scalloped hammerhead shark relies on a special oil in its liver to survive the crushing pressures of the deep sea. Shark liver oil, or squalene, is a fatty substance that provides vital buoyancy for this critically endangered species and many others. But it's also a lifesaver for humans as a boosting agent in vaccines called an adjuvant, and improves the immune system and make vaccines more effective. Stay with us for an article penned by Justin Meneguzzi, a commentator and writer, under the heading, Why a COVID-19 Vaccine Could Further Imperil Deep Sea Sharks. Stay with us for more of Justin Meneguzzi's article. As the world's pharmaceutical companies scramble to create a vaccine for COVID-19, at least 5 of the 202 vaccine candidates rely on shark liver oil, or squalene, sourced from wild caught sharks. One candidate is a vaccine developed in Australia by the University of Queensland in partnership with the Australian biopharmaceutical company CSL and its subsidiary Seqirus. The as-yet-unnamed vaccine contains the squalene adjuvant, MF59, which is sourced from a variety of shark species. It entered human clinical trials earlier this year, and if successful, will result in an initial production of 51 million doses. Tens of millions of sharks are caught and traded internationally each year, both legally and illegally, the majority for their meat and fins, but roughly 3 million or more for their squalene, or shark liver oil. It takes the livers of between 2,500 and 3,000 sharks to extract about a ton of squalene. Conservationists fear that increased demand for shark liver oil or squalene for vaccines, among other uses, could further imperil shark species, a third of which are vulnerable to extinction. Stephanie Brendel, founder and executive director of Shark Allies, a conservation non-profit organization, says this is an unsustainable demand to place on a finite natural resource like sharks. Only about 1% of shark liver oil or squalene ends up in vaccines, and most goes into cosmetics such as sunscreens, skin creams, and moisturizers. Even so, as the global population booms, the need for vaccines will only increase in the coming years. Stephanie Brendel notes, adding that some medical experts suggest that people will require multiple doses of vaccines against COVID-19. Stephanie Brendel adds, "We're not saying that vaccine trials should stop, but if we keep viewing sharks as an easy solution and don't consider the alternatives that exist, then we'll just continue to use squalene as a template for vaccines." In light of the declining shark population, some biotechnology companies are looking for other sources of shark liver oil or squalene. Plants such as sugarcane, olives, amaranth seeds, and rice bran, for instance, all contain the substance. While plant-based alternatives are being tested in studies and clinical trials, regulatory agencies such as the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, FDA, have yet to approve them as part of a final vaccine product. For centuries, people have exploited shark liver oil for food and energy. Liver oil, for example, fueled streetlights across 18th century Europe. The oil has also long been used in textiles and food coloring, as well as cosmetic products. But it wasn't until 1997 that Chiron, a former biotechnology company that's since been acquired by Novartis, used squalene as an adjuvant in the Fluad influenza vaccine. Other major pharmaceutical companies began to rely on squalene for their seasonal flu and swine flu vaccines. While the overwhelming majority of sharks are unintentionally caught by large-scale fisheries pursuing tuna, squid, and salmon, deficiencies in reporting mean it is difficult to disentangle legitimate bycatch from illegal fishing activities. The species of shark being traded is also rarely identified in trade records. To meet the demand for shark liver oil, a specialized industry of fishermen, producers, and traders have developed, especially in Indonesia and in India. In a process dubbed livering, fishermen kill a shark to remove its liver, then throw the rest of the carcass overboard. In processing centers on land, the livers are minced, boiled, and placed in tanks, where they are put in a centrifuge to separate the oil from any residue. The shark liver oil is then packaged and shipped around the world. 1 ton of shark liver oil could be worth thousands of dollars, depending on its squalene content. In a 2014 report, the non-profit organization Wildlife Risk described a factory in southeastern China that was illegally processing 600 whale sharks, a protected species, and basking sharks a year. Though all sharks have squalene, fishermen target deep-sea species, which have the biggest livers and thus the highest concentrations of the oil. These sharks are especially vulnerable to overfishing because they mature slowly. Some take a decade to begin reproducing. As a result, nearly half of the 60 shark species most wanted for their livers, including the scalloped hammerhead shark, the long-fin mako shark, and the whale shark, are considered vulnerable to extinction by the International Union for Conservation of Nature, IUCN, the body that sets the conservation status of wild animals and plants. Many of those species are protected under the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species of Wild Fauna and Flora, or CITES, which restricts or bans fishing of certain marine species such as sharks and rays. Joanne Cleary, a spokesperson for Sequirus, which uses the squalene adjuvant MF59, told National Geographic that their squalene is sourced from shark species that aren't protected under CITES. In a follow-up request, Joanne Cleary did not say whether Sequoia's suppliers meet sustainable fishing standards set by the Marine Stewardship Council. According to Stephanie Brendel of Shark Allies, just because a fishery avoids protected species doesn't mean it's sustainable. Only a handful of species are legally protected, and getting a new one onto protection list takes years. Losing top marine predators such as the scalloped hammerhead shark could be disastrous for the environment, according to Austin Gallagher, a National Geographic explorer and chief scientist at Beneath the Waves, a Virginia-based shark conservation group. Sharks play a crucial role as the natural white blood cells of our oceans, Gallagher says. They keep our ecosystems robust by eating other animals that are sick, injured, or not fit to pass on their genes. They're agents of natural selection in the most poetic way. Stephanie Brendel, founder and executive director of Shark Allies, a conservation and non-profit organization, says the onus is on pharmaceutical companies to begin developing viable alternatives to shark squalene to present to regulators. She points out that Novavax, a vaccine development company, is already using an alternative squalene adjuvant, Matrix-M, in clinical trials for its experimental COVID-19 vaccine. Matrix-M is made from bark of the soapbark tree, which is abundant in Chile. Cleary, the Sequoia's spokesperson, says that at this stage, alternative squalenes have not been approved by regulators for use in vaccines due to the purity levels required. However, the Infectious Disease Research Institute found that pharmaceutical-grade squalene produced by a biotechnology company, Amyris, met and in some cases exceeded the safety and purity profiles of shark-based squalene, according to Chris Padden, Amyris's lead scientist. Amyris is banking on sugarcane as a solution to shark-based squalene, he says. In southeastern Brazil, the company is growing thousands of acres of bamboo-like sugarcane to be processed into squalene. Just 24 acres of sugarcane could, in theory, produce enough squalene to support 1 billion COVID-19 vaccines. Because growers can't control the way sugarcane is grown and harvested, it's possible to ensure the quality of the squalene, Padden says. When you use animal products, there are impurities that come with them because of the environment they're raised in and the places where they're processed. Furthermore, Padden says, growing sugarcane is also cheaper than catching sharks and removing their livers. Beneath the Waves, Gallagher adds, the pandemic has heightened public scrutiny of the vaccine development process and exactly what goes into our medicines. One of the other significant things that also has come out of this pandemic, he says, has been simply shining a light on the greater environmental issue at hand here, which is the significant loss of sharks from our oceans that is happening on a global scale.
Good morning.
morning.
Good morning.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.